Well, our Haftorah portion this morning is Haftorah Tzaveh. It comes from Ezekiel chapter 43, verses 10 to 27. Now, we've been in Ezekiel once already in this Haftorah cycle, and we'll be visiting Ezekiel again as we get into the book of Leviticus. But this Haftorah portion was chosen because if you've been reading the Torah portions, you know that in this week's Torah portion, which is in Exodus chapters 27 up through part of chapter 30, in the Torah portion, it discusses more about the tabernacle, especially the clothing of the priest and the dedication or the inauguration of the priest. In Hebrew, to inaugurate someone means to fill their hands, the milui yadim, the filling the hands, giving the hands something to do. I love that. Inaugurate is our English word, but in Hebrew, you're filling the hands of someone. We're going to see that phrase used in this week's Haftorah portion in Ezekiel. We also see the incense altar being constructed in the directions and instructions for constructing the golden altar of incense. So, the rabbis of old chose this portion of Ezekiel to go with that portion of Exodus. And we begin in Ezekiel chapter 43, verse 10. It says, "You, Ben Adam, you, son of man, you mortal, tell the house of Israel of the house, and let them be ashamed of their sins and measure the design." One of the things we're going to point out as we read through this Haftorah portion is that Ezekiel uses very odd terminology, unusual things. The parts of the temple he describes here are given different names many times, and what is are given to the parts of the tabernacle and the parts of Solomon's temple, the nomenclature, the descriptions and the names of things are very different here. Now, Ezekiel does use the word temple, hechal, in Hebrew a few times, just a few times. But after the previous chapter, he doesn't use the word temple anymore. The temple is always referred to as habet, the house, the house. It says, "Tell the house of Israel of the house, and let them be ashamed of their sins, and measure the design. And if they are ashamed, then you can tell them of the form of the house and its design, its exits and entrances, and all its appearance, its laws, all its decoration, and all its regulations make known to them, and write it down before their eyes, that they may remember its form and its decrees and perform them." Now, unlike the description of the tabernacle, that description in Exodus tells them how to make every detail of the tabernacle and all of its furniture and the clothing of the priest. But there are no instructions here as how to make this temple. If we go back to where this description of the temple begins, go back to chapter 40, Ezekiel chapter 40, verse 1. Ezekiel, by the way, was a priest. He was of the priestly family. He's in exile in Babylon, along with Daniel and his friends and thousands of other Jewish people. And they're going to be in Babylon for 70 years. But being a priest, it is appropriate that God would select him to walk him through this vision of this future tabernacle, the third temple, the millennial temple. And it says there in verse 1, "In the 25th year of our exile, on the new year." Now, when is the new year? Okay, not Passover. That's the beginning of the months. But what's the beginning of the year? That'd be Rosh Hashanah, okay, which is in the first day of the seventh month. And then it says, "And in the 14th year, on the 10th of the month, in the 14th year of the city had fallen, on that very day, the hand of Adonai came upon me. And he brought me there. In visions of God, he brought me to the land of Israel and set me down on a very high mountain, and near it was the appearance of a built city to the south. So this vision of the temple shows Jerusalem to the south of the city, not to the west and the north of the city as it is now, but now it's on the south of the city. So this is a picture of the future, of the, what we would call the millennium, when the kingdom arrives. Now he brought me there, and behold, a man whose appearance was like that of copper, with a linen cord in his hand and a measuring rod, as he stood by the gate. The man spoke to me, "Ben-Adam, look with your eyes, with your ears, listen, and apply yourself to all that I show you. For in order to show you, have you been brought here? Relate all that you see to the family of Israel." And then it goes on, and we're off to the races, describing this incredible, this amazing structure. Let me just give you a little glimpse of what this looks like. This is a schematic of the third temple. Does it all show up there? Pretty much. You'll notice that instead of being rectangular, this one is completely square. And there's a wall around what you see here, but I just don't have it in this diagram. But there's another wall outside of this. It's like a lattice work fence. And on a side, picture this length here as basically about 2 football fields long, roughly. About 2 football fields long, 2 football fields wide. Smack in the middle of this complex is the altar. Now, remember that when they built Herod's temple, the temple that Yeshua visited when he was on earth, it was not built according to this plan, even though this plan existed. They had the book of Ezekiel then. But the one part of Ezekiel's temple that they did reconstruct was the altar. The altar in Herod's temple was like the altar described here in Ezekiel's temple, but nothing else is, but just that altar. So if you see some artist renderings of the altar in Herod's temple, and there are plenty of them out there, you're basically looking at the altar just like the one that is going to be in this third temple that will be built. Everything else there was different. Back here is the holy place, back in here, and there is the Holy of Holies, back in the back. But you have these large structures, stone structures built around. Everything is so magnificent with beautiful stone and gold, and there's all these entrances And as you read through Ezekiel's description, there's incredible detail given. There are several books out that you can read that give you details of Ezekiel's temple. One of the newest ones, and probably the best one, is called The Messianic Temple. It's by Chaim Klorfein, and it is published by Menorah Press. And as you go through here, the author had a computer programmer go through and do computer-generated images of all the details and plans, and it is quite a book. It really is quite a book, very heavily illustrated. And as you go through, it'll have the Hebrew and the English of each verse of Ezekiel 40 through 48. And it'll translate and describe what's going on, give you illustrations of every single detail. But then it'll also give you the traditions and the ancient Hebrew lore about this, which you can take or leave. But it is very complex and very interesting. But the question remains, why is it important? Why is it important for us? And I hope that by the end of the lesson you'll see why studying these details can hold just a wealth of insight and blessing for us. Now, our portion starts out with, tell them the basics so that they'll be ashamed of their sins. And if they are, then give them the rest. There's this wonderful passage in the Midrash Tanhuma. The Midrash is a word for ancient Bible studies. And listen to what it says. Come and see that when the Holy One, blessed is He, showed Ezekiel a vision of the Beit. The Beit means the house, or the Beit HaMikdash, the holy house. I'll just use the word temple. What does he say? He says, tell the house of Israel about the temple, the house, and let them be ashamed of their iniquities, and let them calculate its design. Ezekiel said before the Holy One, blessed is He, master of the universe. Until now, we've been placed in exile in the land of our enemies. And yet you are telling me to go and inform Israel the dimensions of the temple? And you say, write it down before their eyes so that they may safeguard its entire form and all its rules to fulfill them? Can they possibly fulfill this? Let them be until they come up from the exile, and then I will go and inform them. The Holy One, blessed is He, then said to Ezekiel, just because my children are in exile, should the building of the temple be idle? The Holy One, blessed is He, said to him, the reading about it in the Torah is as great as if actually building it. You know, we talk about sacrifices today. We can't do the sacrifices because we don't have a temple. We don't have a Levitical priesthood. But it says there in Hosea that since there basically is no sacrificial system, let the bulls of my lips, let my prayers be the sacrifices. So we can still be involved with a sacrifice of praise, where our prayers take the place of the sacrifices. So here, in this Midrash, God is supposedly saying, their reading about it in the Torah is as great as if actually building it. Go and tell them to become involved with the reading about the dimensions of the temple in the Torah. And as a reward for reading about it and being involved in studying it, I consider it as though they are actually involved in the building of the Beit HaMikdash, the temple. Fortunate is the man who is engrossed in the study of Torah. How gracious this is. Though we cannot visit this temple, because it doesn't exist on earth yet, we can't enter it, we can't experience it physically, God has given us all the details, and we can still experience it in a spiritual way. We can still learn from it, and our lives can be changed by this study. But God tells them, if they're ashamed, give them the details. If they're not, then don't. And I was sharing with the congregation earlier before some of you came in. Shame of your sins is the key and the first step to understanding God's word and being able to feed upon it. If you're not ashamed of your sins, then the insights of the word are going to be hidden from your eyes. But if you are ashamed of your sins, then God can begin to give you insights into His word. But until sin is put aside, then you're going to be blind and deaf to what God would speak to us. So let's pick it up in verse 12. This is the teaching of the house atop the mountain. Its entire boundaries all around is Kadosh Kadoshim, Holy of Holies, or Most Holy. Behold, this is the teaching of the house. Now, as we go through, I'm going to point out some of those odd things Ezekiel does. And I'll just put the picture up here so if it's at all helpful to you. He says, now these are the dimensions of the altar in cubits. Now, a cubit. Now, I don't want you to get distracted by this and measuring yourself and miss the teaching, but a cubit in ancient Israel is considered to be the distance from an average-sized man's elbow until the end of his middle finger. That would be a cubit. And if you measure it, it's five hand spans. One, two, three, four, five. Okay? Five hand spans. I got fat hands. Mine don't work too well. But this was considered to be about five hand span. A tuffik is the word for a hand span. All right? So five hand spans normally equals about one cubit. But this is odd. Look what he says here. Each cubit is a cubit and a hand breadth. So the cubits used for this temple are not your normal cubits. It's like saying that make this certain number of feet long, but not feet of 12 inches. I want your feet to be 15 inches long. You see? We're just going to change the unit of measure here. We're going to stretch the unit of measure. That's very odd. It only happens here in Ezekiel. But it goes on. But the base is to be a cubit, as is the cubit of the width, and its boundary upon its edge all around is half a cubit each. Similarly, the top of the altar, now from the base upon the ground up to the lower Azara. The word Azara is used only here in Ezekiel. Why doesn't he call it by the terms it's used in other places? This little step, this little ledge that goes around the altar. Here he calls it an Azara, which is an unusual word. Only he uses it. It goes on, 2 cubits with a width of 1 cubit from the small Azara up to the large Azara, 4 cubits with a width of 1 cubit. Now the Har El was 4 cubits. Now what does yours say? The hearthstone or the altar hearth or the top of the altar, what does yours say? All right, you got all these different translations. He calls it the Har El, which means the mountain of God. Har is mountain, El is God. Har El, mountain of God. Now the mountain of God was 4 cubits. He's calling the top of the altar the mountain of God. We'll come back to that in a minute. And from the Ariel, and here again, he's calling this section measuring up, and up has 4 horns. Ariel means lion of God. He uses a completely different term. He's describing the altars, no question about that. But he calls the top the mountain of God, and then the perimeter around it, the lion of God. We'll come back to it. Verse 16, the Ariel is 12 cubits long by 12 cubits wide, squared toward its 4 quarters. And the Azara is 14 cubits long by 14 cubits wide towards its 4 quarters. The boundary surrounding it is 0.5 cubit. Its base is 1 cubit all around, and its ramp faces eastward. Wait a minute. That word that's used there, ma'alote, can either be a ramp or steps. But what's the problem with this? Not supposed to be any steps. Not supposed to be any ramp. Back in Exodus 20, right after God gives the Ten Commandments, he gives instructions about building an altar. He says, if you make an altar of stone, do not make it with steps. Don't make it so tall you have to go up by steps or by a ramp. But here, this one has steps. How can God do this? Well, apparently, we didn't make the altar. He says, if you make an altar, to make it so high that you have steps. Apparently, this altar wasn't made by man. Now, here's a thing that's a little bit goofy. And its ramp faces eastward. But look at the illustration up here. In this illustration, east is at the bottom of the page. So if you were staying on the Mount of Olives and going in, this is the east at the bottom. But the ramp is facing what? It's facing south, just as it did in Herod's temple. Why did the rabbis read this, which clearly says the ramp faces eastward, and make the ramp going to the south? Why did they do that? This is one of those little rabbinic things. They believe that, well, when you go up the ramp, you have to turn to the right, which would be the east, as you walk around this ledge and you deal with the things on the altar. So we made the ramp go to the south, so when you get to the top, you turn right, the way it says in the book of Ezekiel. But you know what? I think they're just overthinking this whole thing. I really believe the ramp should be just the way it says. It should be coming to the south. It's almost as if as you go into the courtyard, you go through these magnificent doors, and then it's just like right up to the ramp to the altar. And you have to go over the altar to get to the Holy of Holies. We'll come back to that. We have a lot to come back to, don't we? Verse 18, then he said to me, Ben-Adam, son of man, mortal, thus says my Lord Adonai, these are the requirements of the altar upon the day that it is made, so that burnt offerings may be brought upon it and blood may be sprinkled on it. Give to the Kohanim, the Levites from the tribe of Levi, who are the seed of Zadok, and approach me. Now Zadok was the high priest during David's time, and he was the first high priest in Solomon's temple. The line of Zadok comes from Aaron's son, Eleazar. Aaron had 4 sons, Nadav and Avi, who died in the tabernacle, remember? And then he had 2 other sons, and from Eleazar comes the line of Zadok. So all the priests during the times of the prophets in the temple were from this line. The words of my Lord Adonai, to serve me a bullock from the herd for a sin offering, make some of its blood, take some of its blood and place it upon its 4 horns. Now this altar has 4 horns, one on each corner. We'll see a picture of this a little bit later. And upon the 4 corners of the Azara and upon its boundary all around, cleanse it and purify it. Then take this bullock, which is a cleansing offering, and burn it in the designated place of the house, outside the house, outside the temple. Then on the second day you are to bring near a perfect he-goat for a cleansing offering, and let them cleanse the altar as they had cleansed with the bull. When you have finished the cleansing, bring close a perfect bull from the herd and a perfect ram from the flock, and bring them close before Adonai, and let the Kohanim throw salt upon them and bring them up as a burnt offering to Adonai. Why does he mention putting salt on them? We know in Leviticus that all sacrifices have salt on them. Anything that's put on the altar has salt put on it as well. So why does he have to name it here, specifically name that there's salt thrown on these? Kind of odd. Verse 25, for 7 days, prepare a he-goat every day and a perfect bull from the herd and a ram from the flock they are to prepare. For 7 days, let them purify the altar, cleanse it, and fill its hands. This is the only place in the Bible where that term, meluhi yadim, filling the hands, is used of an inanimate object. When you inaugurate the priest, you fill their hands. Okay? When you're inaugurating a person for particular responsibility, you inaugurate them, you consecrate them, you fill their hands. How do you fill the hands of an altar? Very odd. He's talking of the altar as almost as if it's a living thing. And when the days will have passed, it shall be from the eighth day onward that the Kohanim, the priest, may prepare on the altar their burnt offerings, their peace offerings, and I shall find favor in them. My desire will be toward them, is how it's worded in Hebrew. The words of my Lord Adonai. And that's the end of the Haftorah portion. So let's see what we can discover in this. We'll drill down in just a place or two. Let me catch up with myself here. In Ezekiel 43:15, in verse 15, it says, and the upper altar was 4 cubits, and from the Har El, which means mountain of God, and upward were 4 horns. Here's the word Har El in Hebrew. Har, Hey Resh, means mountain. El is short for Elohim. It means God. Har El means mountain of God. Ezekiel is calling the upper part of the altar the mountain of God. He's telling us that the altar is a miniature Mount Sinai. Now you have to stop. When you see something like this, it only shows up in the Hebrew. But when you see something like this, you must stop and pause and think, what's going on here? We're such physical creatures that we want everything to fix and fit together just exactly perfectly physically. God's not so concerned about that. He's saying the top of this altar is the same as the top of Mount Sinai. To be at one is to be at the other. Because it wasn't some geographical location that was so important for Mount Sinai, it was what happened there. And it's what's happening here that's so important. And what is happening here? Well, on Mount Sinai and on the altar, there's what? There's fire and smoke, right? On Mount Sinai, there was table fellowship with God. Did you ever read the story there in Exodus chapter 24? It's pretty amazing. And I've never seen a movie about the Ten Commandments where they actually did this. And I lost all my page of... Oh, there they are. Listen to this. Exodus 24. God is on Mount Sinai. He's called Moses up. He's given the Ten Commandments and some instructions. He gave the Mishpatim. And then it says this, verses 9 to 11. Then Moses and Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, and 70 of the elders of Israel went up. So there's 74 people who go up to the top of Mount Sinai. And they saw the God of Israel. There was under his feet, as it were, a pavement of sapphire stone, like the very heaven for clearness. What color is sapphire? What color is sapphire? Blue, isn't it? Okay. What's that? Well, there is all colors of sapphire, yeah. But for some reason, I think blue. It's just my own thing. And he did not lay his hand on the chief men of the people of Israel. They beheld God and ate and drank. But the altar is also called God's table many times in the Torah. It's called God's table because when a sacrifice was brought, part of it was burned up on the altar, part was given to the priest, the rest was eaten. And so the altar is a place where God and man have table fellowship. Are you seeing the connections? Another thing, God spoke to the people from Mount Sinai. And God speaks from the altar. It's a place where you come in communion with God and you speak to him, because when you bring a sacrifice, and the sages are very clear on this, when you lay your hands on that sacrifice and you pray, you confess your sins or whatever the purpose of the sacrifice is, you're communing with God. And when you put that part of the animal on the altar and it goes up, it's like you giving yourself to the Lord, because the smoke would just go up. And it would be called an olah, which means to go up. The normal term for sacrifice is a korban, which, and korav, from which it's taken, means to draw close to God. The altar is a place you drew close to him, where you came together. And you wouldn't hear words from him in your ears, but you'd speak to him from your heart. And often he'd speak back to your heart. And words too deep for words. So there's fire and smoke. There's table fellowship. There's communication, communion with God. Mount Sinai and at the altar. And then, on an altar, you know, as you read about this altar in Ezekiel, it talks about its four horns. And altars always had four horns, a horn at each corner. Now, these horns, traditionally, what they were, their purpose was that when you brought the sacrifice, you could tie the sacrifice to the altar, to the horn of the altar. You know, you'd have it like on a leash. You could take the leash and tie it around one horn so the sacrifice doesn't go astray and run off while you're preparing the wood and the fire and everything. But there's no place in the scriptures that I can find where an animal is ever tied to the horn of an altar. They are purely ornamental. But here's what it says about the altar and the tabernacle, Exodus 27:2. It says, "And you shall make horns for it on its four corners. And its horns shall be of one piece with it, and you shall overlay it with bronze." So this is in the tabernacle. There's a picture. This is a very small altar compared to the one in Ezekiel's temple. But there are the horns. Okay? We're not sure exactly what they look like, but there are these protrusions at the four corners. And in most altars that were built by people in ancient days, this is where you could tie up your sacrifice. But in the Bible, these horns are always purely ornamental. They were never used. I can't find a record where anything was ever tied. I know Joab, when he was fleeing from Solomon, he knew he was in big trouble, so he ran to the tabernacle and grabbed hold of the horns of the altar. Didn't help him. He still killed him. But I don't see any place where something's tied to these horns. They're ornamental. But everybody understood the purpose was, that's where you tie up the sacrifice. You know, whenever we talk about an altar, I think of Romans 12:1, where Paul says, "I appeal to you, therefore, brothers, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God," which is a spiritual worship. And that word for spiritual worship, or reasonable service, I think the King James puts it, is the word latreion in Greek. It's only used five times in the New Testament. But in all the other four times, it refers to the sacrificial system. It refers to the temple service of bringing an animal to an altar. And what Paul is saying here, when he says spiritual worship, he's saying, this is your temple service. This is how you serve in the temple now. You're the sacrifice. Let me give you a little background. There were two orders of priests in the Bible. There's the Levitical priest, and they brought animals and sacrificed animals. But there's also the order of Melchizedek. And we only have one priest in the Bible to really look at as an example of this. There's Melchizedek, And there's only a couple verses about him in Genesis, and then he's mentioned again in Psalms and mentioned over in Hebrews. But there's not much detail about him. But in Psalms and Hebrews, we know that the son of David, our Messiah, is a priest after the order of Melchizedek. So if Yeshua is the priest after the order of Melchizedek, the high priest after the order of Melchizedek, what is the sacrifice? What did Yeshua bring as a sacrifice? Himself. In the Levitical priesthood, you bring an animal as a sacrifice, but in the order of Melchizedek, you are the sacrifice. We've been made a kingdom of priests. Unless we're descendants of Aaron, we can't be Levitical priests. So what kinds of priests must we be after the order of Melchizedek? What is the sacrifice we bring? Ourselves. You understand? Another thing, and I'm probably all of you aware of this, but in case one of you is not, I want to repeat this as well. As you go through Leviticus, it makes it very clear, I think it's in Leviticus chapter 7, and then it's repeated again a few chapters down. It says that when a sacrifice is brought, a person brings a sacrifice to the tabernacle, he brings it to the priest who is on duty. And the priest will coach him and walk him through the steps, and then the animal's cut and killed, and parts are put on the altar, and everything's done. The priest oversees everything. And as I said before, part of the animal's burned up on the altar, goes up in smoke, just ascends. Part of it is given to the priest as his payment. He gets to eat it. And the rest of the meat, the person who brings the sacrifice takes and he eats with his family and friends. It's a great celebratory occasion. But Leviticus is very clear and says, but the hide of the sacrifice belongs to the priest. It always belongs to the priest. You don't take the hide home. It is skinned right there, and the skin becomes the property of the priest. So priests had quite an industry in leather. And these skins, these hides, would they'd be scraped and prepared in some location. And then what would the priest do with these hides? Make them into Torah scrolls, into scrolls that go in the mezuzahs, into the holy books, and later into books that would contain the words of Ezekiel and the prophets and the Psalms, the writings. In other words, you brought a sacrifice. Get the picture now. You bring a sacrifice. You go through everything. It's skinned. And then when you walk out with the meat from the sacrifice to eat with your family and friends, the skin stays behind and becomes the priest's property. And then the priest would prepare this. And the priests are the ones who would then make the Torah scrolls and record God's word. See the picture here? If we're living sacrifices, that means everything inside this hide of mine, my heart, my mind, my emotions, my thoughts, everything, they belong to God. The hide's left behind. Doesn't go. You never burn the hide on the altar. You don't see that anywhere. The hide's left behind, but who's it belong to now? Who does this hide belong to? It belongs to the priest. Belongs to my Messiah, who's my high priest after the order of Melchizedek. And what does he want to do with this hide of mine? He wants to use it to proclaim his word. He wants me to be a living Torah scroll. He wants me to be his epistle. You understand what being a living sacrifice is? What's inside the body, that invisible part of you goes up to him. The hide left behind is his property now. And he wants to shape it and scrape it and do all the things to it that's so unpleasant so he can proclaim his word to the world. That's what we are to be, living Torah scrolls. Adam, I see your hand up. Yes. In the temple, it always took place on the north side of the altar. And if you get a good description of the temple, there were posts and tables right there in the open. And the posts are used to hang the animal, and the tables are used to butcher it. In Ezekiel's temple, earlier on in the book, it describes the rooms. These are rooms inside, and there are even pictures in this book I held up that show the priest butchering the animals and doing all those things. But there's a large space dedicated to that. Yeah. In Solomon's temple and Herod's temple, there was a means for washing that away. And when it would rain, it would all go down. It would go. There were places for the blood to go and flow out into the Kidron Brook, into the valley there, and just be washed away. Yeah, so they had all those things covered. Yeah, but you bring up some very good points. Yes, Jenna. Yes, a skin of an animal used to cover Adam and Eve. Yes, yeah. Interesting thing, and this is off subject, but the word for skin in Hebrew is the word or. It's ayin vav resh, or. Just you, in English, you'd spell it O-R, or. That means skin, hide. And when it talks about Adam and Eve, he made coats of or for them. But the word for light in Scripture is Aleph, Vav, Resh, and it's pronounced Or, O-R. So when someone says, what's the Hebrew word Or mean? You say, well, how is it used? It can either mean skin or it can mean light. Okay? And so if our hides are devoted to the Lord, if we're truly living sacrifices, and he makes us into a living epistle, living Torah scroll, that means that I'm a light to the world. And isn't that what we're supposed to be? Let your light so shine among men? They may see your what? Your good works. How do we know what good works are? The Torah. The Torah tells us what's good works and what's not. Right? Sin is Torahlessness. When you live your life apart from the Torah, you're not doing good works. That may seem good to you. But when you submit your actions to the commandments of Torah, they're truly good works, and they go forth. People see them as light. It's an incredible thing. Hebrew is an amazing language. So anyways, thank you, Jenna. So we are called to be living sacrifices, holy and acceptable to God. And this is our act of temple worship, of temple service to God. Oh, yes, Fred, I didn't see your hand up.
I see this, the renewal of vows that were made at Sinai, where the elders went up, the Holy One, blessed be He, comes, and they say to him, everything that you have said we will do.
Yes.
So this is a renewal of vows that God is asking of Israel.
Right.
In this marriage covenant.
Right. It's a covenant. Right.
And the renewal of the vows has to have blood in it.
Yes.
Because this is the cleansing. The salt is also the cleansing.
Yeah.
Both Peter and Paul, when they were killed in Rome, one killed upside down.
Right.
And Paul was beheaded. As he said to Shema.
Yeah.
So they were saying that they were sold out.
Yeah.
To the Lord.
Yes. Yeah. Fred, you said a lot there in just a short time, but the main thing Fred is saying is that this is a covenant we're entering into, and when you enter into a covenant, there's a shedding of blood, but there's always a meal, a covenant meal together. And so I can't sum up everything you said, but that was very good. You people on the tape and on the internet, you just missed out. That's all there is to it. Yes, Rob.
Grant, what Fred said, plus, to keep it in perspective, this is during the millennium reign.
Yes.
This is when Yeshua is ruling in Jerusalem. This is yet
to happen. Oh, yes. Yeah, this nonsense about there will not be any more sacrifices because the Messiah has come, it's nonsense. It's totally unscriptural. The scriptures make it abundantly clear that when Messiah returns, the sacrificial system once again resumes. And you can argue about it all you want, but the Bible's the Bible's the Bible. And it just makes it abundantly clear that the sacrificial system does resume when Messiah returns. Well, anyways, as I was studying this, I got this notion. I'm going to share it with you. But the more I thought about it over the last day or two, I really believe that this is an important insight and part of what God would seek to teach us from the book of Ezekiel. You know, I was reading these verses. Let's just look at them quickly again. You shall make, back in Exodus 27:2, you shall make horns for it on its four corners. Its horns shall be of one piece with it, and so on. And Paul tells us, I appeal to you, therefore, brothers, by the mercies of God, present your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God, which is your temple service, it's your spiritual worship. And that four corners kept reminding me of the tallit, where it says in Deuteronomy 22:12, for example, and you shall make for yourselves tzitzit on the four corners of the garment with which you cover yourself. Here's a garment. The only thing that makes this garment special is the fact that it has four corners, and on the corners there's a tzitzit. And as we read in the prayer service, you're put on the tzitzit, the cord of Tekhelet. That's the blue thread that you see. And then why do we do this? Why does God give this commandment? Well, Numbers 15, verses 37 to 40, here's what it says. Adonai said to Moshe, speak to the people of Israel, instructed them to make through all their generations tzitziot, that's the plural of tzitzit, on the corners, and then Deuteronomy refers specifically to four corners, on the corners of their garments, and put with the tzitzit on each cord a cord of tekhelet, which is this blue color. It is to be a tzitzit for you to look at, and thereby remember all of Adonai's mitzvot, all of his commandments, and obey them, so that you won't stray after your own heart and eyes that lead you to prostitute yourselves. You know, it's the heart and the eyes that led Adam and Eve astray. Isn't that the truth? But it will help you remember and obey all my mitzvot and be holy for your God. I started thinking about this. If the altar is a miniature Mount Sinai, if the altar is a place of fire and smoke, of table fellowship with God, of communion with God, and if I am to be a living sacrifice, that means I'm to be on this altar. And like somebody once said, the problem with living sacrifices is they keep crawling off the altar. But this altar has four horns, one on each corner, to which, although they're merely ornamental, they were meant there to tie the sacrifice. And I tend to stray away from being a living sacrifice. I'm always straying after my eyes and after my heart. I'd be embarrassed to tell you, we're sitting here praying, I'm just so focused on the words, you know, and just I'm just right in the groove, right on track. A few minutes later, I'm thinking about having to change my daughter's spare tire yesterday when she hit a pothole. And it's like, how did I get there? I was praying. How did my mind just stray away? And I had to get it back on track. I have no idea how I got there. Do you do the same thing, or is it just me? I mean, that's a small thing, just a thought begins to get off track. But how about big things? When you know what you should be doing, but then a temptation comes over here, and this is a big thing. It seems small, but if you follow through with it, it has devastating consequences in your life. And Andrew, I see your hand up. Is there? You found one. I couldn't find one. Can you read that for us? Psalm 119:27. 118:27. There we go, Psalm 118:27. Thank you, Andrew. I looked and looked. I couldn't find one. You get extra points. I wish I had a grade book. I'd give you extra credit for that. So there we are tying the festival sacrifice to the horns of the altar. Thank you very much. But, you know, even there, I'm wondering. Anyways, I'll have to think about that. So, back to the altar. The sacrifice to be tied to these, mostly for the most part, ornamental horns. And God has given us ornaments to put on the four corners of our garments so that we do not stray. So when we see it, we won't stray after our hearts and our minds. But we'll see them and remember to keep his commandments. Where did the commandments come from? Mount Sinai. In other words, always be tuned in to the Mount Sinai channel. To always be hearing those words, to follow those commandments, because then we will be what? We will be holy for our God. And Paul says we're to be living sacrifices, holy and acceptable to God. And we read in Ezekiel that if they were to build this altar and purify it and do what it says, that they would be desirable to God. They would be acceptable to him. So I kept seeing these connections between the tzitzit on the four corners of a garment to the four horns of the altar. Because I don't have a literal altar to tie myself to. There's no literal altar you get on top of to serve God. It's a picture of a spiritual reality. It pictures something that can't be pictured. It pictures something that in our hearts and minds, we understand it, though there's no physical thing we can do about it. And even here, God says, now here's something physical in the four corners. Put these tzitzit so you don't stray. But you remember my commandments. You remember what I said at Mount Sinai. This is how we become living sacrifices. But it doesn't stop there. I want you to look at a verse here. It's interesting. In Exodus 34:30, it says, Aaron and all the people of Israel saw Moses. This is after he'd spent the 40 days and 40 nights. He comes down. It says, behold, the skin of his face shone. Okay, it shined. And they were afraid to come near him. His face just glowed. You know the story. Well, that word shone is the word spelled Kof Resh Nun. And if it's pronounced Karan, it means shine. If it's pronounced Karen, it means horn. Same word. Now, this is why pictures of Moses, and some of them, like this statue on the left, I saw this. It's in Rome, and one of the basilicas there is a huge thing. It's done by Michelangelo, but look what Moses has on his head. Horns. Somebody got the wrong vowel points on the word Karen there, didn't they? They took the word Kof Resh Nun, and remember, there's only consonants in Hebrew. There's the K sound, there's the R sound, and there's the N sound. So that can be pronounced Karen or Karan. If it's Karen, it's a horn. If it's Karan, it means shine. So here we see a picture of Moses. It still made it look like shiny horns when the word says his face just glowed, but who knows? Isn't that interesting? There's this magnificent statue of Moses that's just so dead wrong, with horns growing out of his head, for Pete's sake, because of a mistranslation of one Hebrew word. But here's my point. This word has a couple different meanings. It can mean a horn, and this is the same word used for horns of the altar, or it can mean to shine. Now, what are these tassels on the corners of the garment called? Tzitzit. Here's what the word looks like. The word tzitz is where we get the word tzitzit, which means a tassel, but it also means tzitz, a shining thing. Is that coincidence, you think? That the word tzitz and the word Karen, or Quran rather, both mean to shine. The horns were a picture of keeping the animal from straying from its purpose in life, which was to be a sacrifice. The purpose of these tassels is to keep our hearts and minds focused on him so we do not stray after our hearts and minds. but to fulfill our life's purpose of being a living sacrifice and being a shining thing, to be a light to the world. All right, am I crazy? Is this just coincidence? Or is God definitely making a picture here for us? Am I saying you're sinning if you don't put tassels on the four corners of your garment or to wear a prayer shawl? The Bible doesn't tell us when to wear one, if it's 24/7 or just when we pray. It doesn't tell us whether we put the tzitzis on the inside under our clothes or on the outside where people can see them. It doesn't tell us much how to do it. But having something to look at, having something that reminds us that we are living sacrifices. I've given up my right to myself. That's what denying myself means. It doesn't mean denying yourself things. I have to live in poverty. It means I deny my right to myself. I am not my own. I am bought with a price. I do not hold the title deed to Grant Luton. That has been relinquished to my Creator, to my Redeemer who purchased me. He owns the title deed to me. I am his. So that means I can be a rebel and say, I know you owe me, but I'm doing things with my life the way I want to. Or I can submit and fulfill my life's purpose because I'm created for good works in Messiah Yeshua. And this before the creation of the world. They were set up for me before the world was created. How do I know what those good works are? They're recorded for me in the Torah. How frustrating it was for me as a Christian who truly desired to serve God, and I didn't have much of a notion how to do it because I put aside God's commandments in the Torah, and I just tried to be good on my own. What a flop that was. Once in a while I did it right. But to discover the Torah and to realize there's so many things I thought that were good that God says, that doesn't please me all that much, and it really is a distraction to everybody else as well. There are other things I thought just weren't important, and God says, no, these indeed are good things. You need to focus on doing them. And just as David says, that the Torah restores his soul, and through the Torah he finds peace in his soul. My testimony is, there are two great events in my life. When I gave my life to the Lord when I was a sophomore in college, and my life changed forever. The next time, after years and years of joy and frustration mixed together, discovering that God's Torah is for me. It was like being saved again. And that's my message. I know my Christian brothers, sisters, I'll talk with them, they kind of look at me weird because they talk, their purpose in life is to save souls. And I say, my purpose in life is to save Christians. Because there's a way God has given us to live. He has given us a handbook for the Christian life, a discipleship manual on how to live the redeemed life. It's called the Torah, his instruction. We want to be living sacrifices. Then we need to remember his commandments that he gave him Mount Sinai. Because the altar to which we are to be tied, the altar upon which we give ourselves as living sacrifices, is a Har El. It is a mountain of God. You see the connections? There's so many, it's hard to even review them without doing the whole teaching over again. In Hosea 14:2, it says, take your words and return to Adonai. Ask him to forgive all iniquity and teach us the good. And we will pay with the words of our lips instead of bulls. We don't have a sacrificial system now. It'll come when Messiah returns. But right now, the sacrifices we bring are ourselves. And out of the heart, the mouth speaks our words. Our hearts and minds are given over to him. What's inside the hide belongs to the priest. What's left behind is still here, but it belongs to him as well. I'm going to close with a quote from this book about the temple that I held up earlier, about sacrifices. We tend to look at the Jewish people, the Orthodox Jews, and Jews historically, and think, oh boy, they just didn't understand the sacrifices at all. But you know they did. I think much better than we do. This is from page 149 of this. Listen, it's just a few paragraphs. It says the atonement attained through animal sacrifices. The word atonement means the covering, you know, the efficacy of a sacrifice, is based on the recognition that two opposing forces exist within man: the animal and the divine. Two opposing forces. What does Paul say? It says the flesh, which is animal, okay, it's biological, it's animal, flesh and bone, blood. It has strong desires that are at war with the spirit, and the spirit has strong desires that conflict with the flesh. We have two opposing forces that are at war within us. That's exactly what this rabbi is saying. The divine pulls man toward God, and the animal nature impels him to satisfy his physical desires. Since the animal self caused him to sin, he expiates the sin by bringing an animal sacrifice to God. The person confesses his sin to God, leaning his weight upon the head of the animal. You know, in the Torah, it says you lay hands on the animal. They didn't just lay their hands on the animal. It says they press down. That's what the Hebrew word is. You put your weight on that animal's head. You're putting yourself on the animal. Leaning his weight upon the head of the animal as if transferring his burden to it. The priest then slaughters the animal and burns portions of it on the altar, symbolizing the destruction of the animal in man. The person bringing the sacrifice meditates on this. His heart is humbled, subjugating his animal self and liberating his soul to be in communion with God. I love that phrase. I used to think the commandments of the Torah were so burdensome, so heavy, so dull. And I would look at the Orthodox Jewish world, and it really looked that way. And to them it is. But with Messiah, keeping those commandments are liberating. You know, last week we talked about the liberty that comes through Torah, the freedom, the life, the elevated level of life, the elevated level of the soul by keeping those commandments. It's just, it's counterintuitive. But it's incredible, and I know many of you here can testify to that. It's liberating his soul to be in communion with God. The communal sacrificial service concludes with a wine libation, the very last thing that would take place in the tabernacle or the temple. Once the day was reaching completion, they would take a pitcher of wine, and they would do the wine sacrifice, drink offering it's called. They would pour it out on the corner of the altar. Once that's done, day's over, temple's locked, the priests go home, get some rest. This is why Paul, twice in his writings, he says, I'm being poured out as a drink offering. He's saying, I've lived a life of sacrifice to the Lord, and now it's reaching completion, and I'm being poured out. The day's almost over. But anyways, I'm getting distracted. The communal sacrificial service concludes with a wine libation, a drink offering, during which the Levites sing songs and the temple orchestra plays. The music is so sublime that the person seeking atonement is raised to spiritual heights. His animal nature is entirely sublimated and atonement is attained. The Hebrew word for sacrifice, korban, comes from the root word karav, meaning close, to draw near. Since it brings man close to God. Praying is a similar process. With temples in a state of destruction, or when we are prevented from going there, prayer is the service of the heart that substitutes for animal sacrifice, as it says in Hosea 14:2. Take your words and return to Adonai. Ask him to forgive all iniquity and teach us the good, and we will pay with the words of our lips instead of bulls. Isn't that beautiful? So this is how we sacrifice. We're the sacrifices. Our hearts and minds produce the words we offer up to God. And you know, quit thinking that the animal sacrifice is the real kind and this is just like a substitute. It's the other way around. This is the real kind. The pictures and the altar and the fire were just pictures. They were just pictures. Those physical things were just illustrations of the spiritual reality. This is the real kind of sacrifice, where the animal sacrificed is you, your animal nature. It's always wanting to go astray. You need to tie yourself to the horns of that altar. And how you do that is by remembering God's commandments and being totally committed to obeying Him and not following your own hearts and eyes, after which we prostitute ourselves. The prayer book uses a more gentle term, but in the Hebrew, it's the word zonah. It's the word prostitute yourselves. We take what we're in, instead of fulfilling the covenant we have with God, we break that covenant and we want to connect with things that are not God. We take what is His and give it to another as a form of adultery, of spiritual adultery. You need to be very careful of that. Mike, I see your hand up. Yes. Yeah, you know, going back to this picture of the temple, what's central in this temple? Right smack in the middle, the altar. It's kind of emphasizing. Is that what you're going to say?
I think it's someone raising holy.
Yeah. Yes. You know, Mike, I thought of that, and I thought, that's so bizarre, I'm not even going to share it. But I'm glad God provided you to do that for me. And you know, it really isn't bizarre. God does things like this all the time. What Mike is saying, you see, this is like the head up here. The Holy of Holies is right there. And the high priest would wear the zitz, it's called. The golden headplate is called a zitz, right? And it said, Kadosh l'Adonai, holy unto the Lord. And that's the Holy of Holies. And this is like an arm and another arm and a leg and a leg, and here's the body. And you know, this isn't far-fetched. You know, God's name is spelled Yud, He, Vav, He, right? And I put dashes between there because His name is so holy, I just don't write it out on anything ever. But we're made in God's image, correct? So if you take these letters, and if I draw them kind of like the way they appear in the Torah scroll, there's the Yud. Here's the He. Here's the Vav. And here's the other He. And what do you have a picture of? The head, shoulders, arms, torso, and then two more legs. You see the picture of a man, don't you? Just saying. All right. I didn't want Mike to feel all bizarre by himself. So, all right, Jim, I see your hand up. Yes.
And give them to Him from your lips rather than the sacrifices. Mm-hmm. I always regarded that more as a confession rather than a giving Him praise. More than a sacrifice of yourself, it seems like, especially in Hosea where it says, instead of the sacrifice, give them your lips.
I'm glad you brought that up. Yeah, I for me, for the longest time, those where you bring the sacrifice, your lips, you know, the words in place of sacrifices, would be like a confession. And confession can definitely be a part of it. But remember, nothing unclean is ever put on the altar. You don't put your trash there. You put only what's holy there. And the trash is burned outside the city. Only holy things went on the altar. And so if our prayers are to be the substitute for the animal sacrifices, which we can't do now, they need to be holy things, not just confessing sins all the time. Now, confession, again, is important, but they should be hymns of praise, things that aren't about me, but they're all about Him. You know, I'm reminded, and we'll have to close with this because I see our time is gone. But in Acts, we see this young community of believers. After Shavuot, Pentecost, there in the first century. And it gives us a picture of how the people spent their time together. And in Acts chapter 2, in verse 42, it says, they were continually devoting themselves to the apostles' teaching. And I'd love to have heard what the apostles taught about Ezekiel. what they had to teach. Who knows? Oh, it'd been wonderful. To the apostles' teaching, to fellowship, to the breaking of bread, and to the prayers. If your Bible does not say the prayers, it's been mistranslated. It's not prayer. It's the prayers. What does it mean, the prayers? Well, pick up a prayer book that we use every Shabbat morning. Those are the prayers they were praying. The prayers. The established liturgy that we still pray today. And friends last night were talking. Dan was talking last night about how starting his day with those prayers just sets the focus and the tone for the day. It's like clears a path in front of you for you to walk. It's the prayers. There's no substitute for those. You can bring your own prayers in addition. But there's just nothing better than the prayers. And they were good enough for that first century redeemed community. They're certainly good enough for us. They were the prayers that Yeshua himself prayed. All right, our time is gone. We've got to close. And again, those of you who are visiting or have never stayed for Oneg before, please come join us and have some food with us down the hall. Our Father and King, we praise you and thank you for the wonder of your word, for the wonderful things that you have placed here in the book of Ezekiel for us to discover. And Father, I pray we would realize that we do have access to Mount Sinai. And we do that by making ourselves living sacrifices, by placing ourselves on the Har El, the mountain of God. And there we meet the Ari El, the Lion of God. And Lord, may that lion consume everything within us that needs to be consumed. Destroy everything that needs to be destroyed. Shake everything that needs to be shaken. And then what remains is eternal and good. The silver, the gold, the precious stones. Make us the men and the women you want us to be. Help us to get past our notions of what we should be and replace them with yours. For you're our creator, you are our redeemer. And we know the day is coming that you, our bridegroom, will come to receive your bride. So may we be found to be holy and faithful and always watchful for your return. And if we are, then we'll be able to give you praise and glory in days to come. We praise you even now in Yeshua's name. Amen.